From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. As the House prepares to limit presidential war powers and the Speaker hangs on to impeachment articles,
I'll send them over when I'm ready. And that will probably be soon.
We check in with legal analyst Judge Nancy Gertner. We also talk with Fall River's new mayor.
Not supposed to turn into what we turned into down here, where everything was pushed to the side. That's not what it's about. It's what we can do to make the place a better place to live.
And a recent federal ruling that states au pairs in Massachusetts are protected domestic workers is alarming some host families.
This might be the end of the au pair program if we look at the complications that it's causing and the issues that this ruling is causing. I think we're all saddened by the fact that this might lead to its demise.
We talked to both sides of the au pair debate. And trying to form a new habit? One expert says start small. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. In Washington, the House debates a Democratic proposed resolution that would limit the president's ability to engage in hostilities against Iran. Here's Speaker Nancy Pelosi a little while ago.
To protect American lives and values, we are passing today a war powers resolution to limit the president's military actions. The administration must de-escalate and must prevent further violence. America and the world cannot afford war.
And the speaker also weighed in on when she might send the articles of impeachment over to the Senate.
I'll send them over when I'm ready. And that will probably be soon. We want to see what they're willing to do and the manner in which they will do it. But we will not let them say, oh, this is just like Clinton, fair is fair. It's not.
So joining us to talk about all of that here in Studio 3 is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She is a retired federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always good to be here.
I feel like we've been doing this impeachment thing for a long time.
I think we have.
Yeah. Let's actually start with Iran, because we've got this thing going on with Iran and this question of presidential powers. House is expected to vote later this afternoon on a resolution which would limit the president's powers under the War Powers Resolution of 1973. What does the Constitution say in general about presidential powers in terms of war, when force can be used, who authorizes it, et cetera?
It doesn't say much, but it says that the direct declaration of war has to come from Congress. It is not something the president can do himself. Now, the issue is, what comprises war? The last formal declaration of war was, you know, I think it was either the World War II or the Korean War. There are all sorts of hostilities short of war, which presidents have said that they have the right to engage in. So that's the question. Now, the open question here is whether a targeted assassination of someone who, however good or bad, mostly bad, was a member of the administration in Iran comprises an act of war and therefore should have been done with the formalities that the Constitution requires.
So it could, in fact, be not just the ability to declare war, but if one essentially triggers by an act of war, that might require congressional oversight as well.
Right, but this is an open question. I mean, during the Cold War, there were all sorts of hostilities between the United States and the Soviet Union, which didn't obviously comprise a formal declaration of war, triggering alliances and all sorts of things, but much short of that. And the question is whether in that sort of continuum of action short of a formal declaration of war, Congress should have a role and what that role should be.
Okay, so the administration briefed Congress yesterday, and we've heard some different responses to the sufficiency of that briefing. But one of the things that we have heard is people saying the message to us was, if you question this, you are aiding and abetting the enemy, essentially. The Constitution, I feel like it must have something to say about
that. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all, because the question of what you do in advance of hostilities and then how you investigate afterwards are two separate questions. Congress certainly has a right to investigate the use of power and the circumstances surrounding it or the failure to use power. That's what the Benghazi hearings were about, after all. So the notion that questioning the president's decision is in some way treasonous is not just ridiculous, but inconsistent with checks and balances, fundamentally inconsistent with checks and balances.
I was going to move on, but I want to ask one more thing on that. It also seems like the price we pay to be in an open democracy, that we're in fact then going to debate publicly things that we wish maybe other people couldn't hear or see, but it's the nature of our beast, right?
Right. And there are variations of public. I mean, you're talking about the usual, the norm was to brief the Gang of Eight, those members of the House and Senate that were in positions of leadership before the action. And that would not have been public in the usual sense.
But that didn't happen.
That didn't happen. And then there's briefing afterwards. And there are gradations of how much the administration can share publicly, but not to share anything and to suggest that criticizing the president is somehow aiding and abetting the enemy. It's really not. It's beyond ridiculous. It's dangerous.
Although I will also say, I don't feel like this is the only administration we've heard that from. I feel like we've heard that during times of conflict. I go back to, you know, after 9/11. I think we heard it then, too.
We may have heard it. This has to be sort of part of a pattern of conduct of a president who has essentially undermined the House processes with respect to impeachment, with the House investigative processes short of impeachment, the subpoenas of tax records, et cetera. So it really is a view of executive power, which is, although it's been robust in prior administrations, a view of executive power that is way beyond what others have done.
Okay. I want to move on to impeachment here. It seems like we're at a point where probably soon the Senate will have its rules and the House Speaker will turn over the articles of impeachment. I want to play a couple of clips here from last week, and I want to get your reaction to them in tandem. First is Senator Susan Collins of Maine.
It is inappropriate, in my judgment, for senators on either side of the aisle to prejudge the evidence before they have heard what is presented to us, because each of us will take an oath that I take very seriously, to render impartial justice. That's what it says, impartial justice.
So then we have a clip from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
The oath that senators take in impeachment trials has never meant that senators should wall themselves off from the biggest news story in the nation and completely ignore what the House has been doing. The oath has never meant that senators check all of their political judgment at the door and strip away all of our independent judgment about what is best for the nation.
Kind of feel like both of those things are true. Can both of those things be true?
I think that they both are true. The Senate takes an oath to be impartial, to do impartial justice, which is different than their oath as senators. So what does it mean in this setting? They clearly know what the case is about. They're not like the ordinary juror in an ordinary case who comes in and is asked, do you know anything about this case? And if you know stuff about the case they're about to try, could be disqualified. They clearly come to the table with what they know about it. They come to the table with their judgments. So it is a relative impartiality. They are, as one professor of mine said, to be as free as may be of partisan political motives and pressures, to do the best they can, to be more jury-like than legislator-like.
Okay, to be as free as they may be from partisan and political motives.
Right.
Right? Did I remember that correctly? Okay, so that raises a question that I've been thinking. Doesn't that suggest that senators who stand to personally gain from the president being convicted, meaning senators running for president, Sanders, Warren, Klobuchar, Booker, Harris even, recuse themselves?
Well, if the scholars of the Constitution have addressed that as well. So there were always bound to be people who wanted the president's position in the Senate. We have a tradition of that. McConnell himself announced that he's not impartial. I think if people who were partial disqualified themselves, then we would have a terribly troubling situation, which is the impeachment of a president decided by a very small group of people. So I think the answer is no, they shouldn't disqualify themselves. I think the answer is you try to be as fair as you can possibly be under the circumstances, recognizing that senators, those sworn to be impartial, are not exactly like jurors.
All right. So let's, in our remaining time, let's talk about this question of fair is fair. We heard Nancy Pelosi refer to it in the lead. Mitch McConnell has been arguing that the Senate can start the trial without witnesses because in the Clinton administration impeachment, they started the trial without witnesses, and fair is fair. At the same time, in the Clinton impeachment, the subpoenas were honored in the House, and so there had been witnesses somewhere. Can you have a quality execution of the entire impeachment process if there are no witnesses at any stage? Is that possible?
I think that I can't give the answer in the abstract. Certainly, it would be where one of the articles of impeachment is obstruction of justice for not providing administration officials to testify before the House, you're keeping the Senate from hearing the most relevant evidence to the cause at hand, to impeachment.
And I should clarify, there were witnesses in the House, just not these primary.
That's right. And so I think the issue is if you say that they're saying two things. McConnell and others have said, one, we don't want witnesses, as there weren't witnesses in the Clinton case. And in addition, we don't have to have live witnesses. We can't have any additional evidence than the evidence in the House. The latter point, additional evidence than the evidence in the House, is flatly wrong. The House is like a grand jury making accusations. The Senate is essentially trying those accusations, and is oftentimes in any trial, the Senate tries facts supporting the accusations that may or may not have been heard by the grand jury. So it can be additional evidence. And then on the question of witnesses, trials involve witnesses. And in this particular case, the relevant witnesses have been barred from testifying by the president.
Okay. And we're going to have to stop there. WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, thank you so much for coming.
You're very welcome.
The city of Fall River starts a new chapter this week. It's Mayor Paul Coogan's fourth day on the job. Coogan was elected last fall during a turbulent time for Fall River. Former Mayor Jaisal Correa, while in office, was indicted on federal bribery and extortion charges. We reached Paul Coogan between meetings today to talk about where Fall River is now and what his biggest priorities are.
My first priority is finding out who's in the building and what their names are and what everyone does. We're just trying to get ourselves, get our feet under us.
So for somebody who's never been a mayor, how long does that actually take? Like, how many days will it be before you know who works for you and how to get around the building, et cetera?
Well, this is my fourth day, and I just got pulled out of a meeting to do your radio show, so I'm going to be going back in a few minutes. But it's going to take a little while. I got to believe... I want to say 30 days. I should have a pretty good handle on where we are, because every time you go around to try to, meet people and find out what they're doing, they pull you into a meeting or there's another issue that comes up that has to be addressed. But I love it, and we're making headway every day.
What's been the biggest surprise so far?
The biggest surprise, obviously, the city was not left in good shape.
But you weren't surprised by that.
I was surprised by the level it had drifted down to. Obviously, at the top, we all saw that. That was what everyone saw on the news and in the newspaper. But what happens is it has such a corrosive effect on the climate in the building that it's trying to bring everybody back to the principle that this is all about work and what we can do to help the people.
So would you say then that this needs to be a time of healing for Fall
Absolutely.
River, both among the city, the employees, but also the larger community?
Absolutely. Everybody's got to understand that government does not work that way. Government works to help everybody to have a clean, safe, livable city that's financially sound, and that's the way it's supposed to work. It's not supposed to turn into what we turned into down here, where everything was pushed to the side and individual priorities rose to the top. That's not what it's about. It's what we can do to make the place a better place to live.
So your predecessor, Mayor Jaisal Correa, maintained a strong base of support in the region, even leading up to the election that you won. What are your messages to people who have supported him?
It's a big tent. Everybody fits under it. And welcome aboard. A lot of his real hardcore supporters have come over. We had a free community concert for Christmas, and I saw a number of them there. We had a little luncheon the other day after the inauguration, and some of them were there. And we'll try to bring them back in. I mean, obviously, I believe many of them were duped also. But they're welcome. I mean, as long as everybody stays on the same page, we'll be fine going forward.
So what is the page you want people on? Once the 30 days are over and you sort of have a sense of things, what do you want to get done first and early?
First and early. After we change their attitude, we want people being contributing members of society. And what I mean by that is doing what you need to do with your trash, getting your kids in school, telling the police if you see something wrong, paying your taxes on time, taking pride in Fall River, all the little things that we can do to make the city function well. I mean, I know it sounds very basic, but sometimes people don't look at things that way. I mean, when you grow up with a real cynical form of government around you, people think, oh, everybody's corrupt. Everybody's no good. And it's not that way. There's a ton of good people here. And I think if we can get everybody to pitch in to make the city a better place to live, we'll be fine.
And what do your constituents in return need you to do specifically as mayor?
They need me to show good, honest leadership, make decisions based on what's best for the city, and be out and about. 7:20 this morning, I was at my first roll call for the police department. I did another roll call at 7:50. I went to the administrative team meeting at 8 o'clock, and then I met the dispatchers who were in a training for phone retrieval systems. And that was before my day doesn't start till 9.
Oh, it sounds like your day actually does start before 9.
we go every day.
Let's talk about a couple of specific policy issues.
You got a couple more minutes, though, because I got to get back or I'm going to lose my job.
All right. I'll be fast. You were on the school committee. You've got a deep background in education. What do you think the big education needs of the city are?
We have to find a way to diversify our employees. We need to find a way to get our kids in school. Attendance is a problem. We have to improve our test scores. That's another struggle. Our facilities down here are really almost top shelf. We have a great, great physical building. We're building a new Durfee. Most of our buildings are in good shape, but we need some of the work inside to be done. We got a good staff, but we have to find a way to reach some of these more difficult kids, and we need to do some other things to improve our test scores.
Okay, and you say you have an aggressive plan to fix the streets in Fall River. What's the need and what's your plan?
Well, our streets are, we got a program called Back to Basics, which involves taking the Chapter 70 street fund money. Don't hold me to it. But it's that in combination with bonding. And we had a focus on streetscapes here. We're going to put our focus back on streets. We want to pave as many as we can. I was on a street the other day. It was absolutely horrible. And we're going to fix as many streets as we can, many sidewalks. And I think people down here are very focused on the potholes and the broken sidewalks, and we're going to get into that real quickly.
Okay. One other question that we had was marijuana has been controversial in Fall River, both for the indictments with the mayor, but also there's been controversy around Northeast Alternatives, the one pot shop that's operating, both the sort of the traffic and the impact on the local community, but also the fact that new pot shops are on hold and therefore there's no relief for the pressure of demand on that one shop. What can you and will you do?
Well, we've been in conversation with the Cannabis Control Commission, and our second pot shop is going to open at the opposite end of the city called Hope Health and Heal down on Weaver Street. It's a very big facility, and I believe that that'll take some of the strain off of that one right now. People will drive to Hope Health and Heal from, I'm hoping, this end of the city and get rid of some of the traffic. We looked at the demographics of who's in there, and it's 50% Fall River, 25% Rhode Island, and 25% other towns.
You mean the customer base?
The customer base. So I'm hoping that 50% Fall River, if half of those people stay from the center part of the city north, go to the other place, I think we'll be in good shape.
So you're in the 4th Congressional District. Joe Kennedy is the congressperson. He's running for senator. 6 candidates are running to replace him. They're all from Brookline or Newton. Why do you think that is, and do you think you can get the representation you need for Fall River given that race?
I think they've all been down here. They're very active in our community. They're all trying to, you know, woo us with their message, and I think that they will help us a lot. I have no idea whether they're all from Brookline, though. I wish there was someone more our way, but there's some good candidates, so we'll pick off. But I really have to run, and I appreciate the time you gave me today.
Mayor of Fall River, Paul Coogan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we will talk to both sides in a debate about au pairs in Massachusetts. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Some families that host au pairs in Massachusetts are seeking help from Beacon Hill following a federal ruling last month that protects au pairs as domestic workers, or classes au pairs as the same as domestic workers, requiring they be paid minimum wage and overtime, among other changes. Workers' rights advocates say the ruling is long overdue, but host families are concerned that it will make the au pair model of childcare unaffordable. We're going to speak to people on both sides of the debate. First, we spoke earlier today with Kelly Callahan. She's from Harvard, Massachusetts, and her family hosts au pairs. She's with the group Au Pair Families of Massachusetts. It's a grassroots organization of roughly 1,000 host families concerned about how the ruling will affect the au pair program. Kelly started by telling us how host families are reacting to the federal ruling.
Generally speaking, it's caused a lot of chaos. It happened very quickly, and I think we just didn't see it coming. It was an unknown. And I think where we're all coming from, if you step back beyond the chaos and sort of trying to grapple with how to move forward, I think we're all struggling and saddened by the fact that this might be the end of the au pair program, if we look at it and the complications that it's causing and the issues that this ruling is causing. I think we're all saddened by the fact that this might lead to its demise.
How did the chaos and the being caught by surprise happen? Because the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights took effect in 2015. It was intended to cover au pairs even then. The reason it hasn't is because of a lawsuit. So a lot of people have known this was coming for a long time.
Right. Not the families, not the host families, not the au pairs, current au pairs. I think, you know, if you look at the perspective of the host families, we were not up until December 2nd or whatever. We were not employers. We've been part of a cultural exchange program with people from other countries being brought here on J-1 visas that are not work visas, that are not employment visas, right? Like, they are here for cultural exchange, to experience America, to improve their English, to live with a family, the same way like a Rotary exchange program would work, right? So we haven't been employers. So no, I was not paying attention to the, as a host parent, I wasn't paying attention.
So how did you find out in December then?
The agencies gave us a notification on the 6th that there had been changes and they were going to start grappling with how to inform us how to move forward.
So they must have known those. So do you have concerns that the agencies didn't notify families before the ruling came down?
Yeah, I find it a little strange that, well, I think it's also important to note that one particular agency was very highly involved. I'm not
You mean the one
sure
that filed the suit to stop this?
Yes,
cultural care.
Yes, yeah, and I'm unclear as to what the other agencies thought. I think that this particular ruling, there were precedents in, you know, other states have redone labor laws. Take New York, for example. And every time these happen, New York being the example, most recent, I believe, au pairs were pulled out and separated because they fall into a completely different class that is not an employer-employee relationship.
So let me just ask you, why, for the average listener out there who doesn't have an au pair, they might think, why is it a bad thing for au pairs to be covered under the same rights as any other domestic worker? They work in the home. They are entitled to
sure
rights. What are the concerns there? Why is this such a disaster from the perspective of host families?
Sure, of course. So I think if you actually look at it from the au pair's perspective also, in many cases, they have far better protections under the federal au pair program. If you look at the protections that are given there and what the rules and the guidelines are there, it's actually very protective. I think what people are missing is that the couple of unfortunate stories that have happened and the situations that have come to the forefront in terms of the negativity of the au pair engagements have been things that were covered under the federal program. This new guideline of putting au pairs, classifying them as domestic employees, does nothing for those protections that people are looking for. Whether
but why
it's
is it bad? It adds other things. Why is that a bad thing?
Big challenges are the administration of it. Host families are turned into employees overnight. That means things that I've never done before. It means contracts, which, by the way, my au pair feels uncomfortable signing because they're not supposed to be employed under a J-1 visa. So she's looking at it like, this seems a little bit strange and I'm not supposed to be doing this. But there's contracts. There's different types of timesheets that now have to be tracked. There's workers' comp that I have to get. There's an administrative aspect of it. In addition to, it changes the dynamic pretty significantly with the cultural exchange program because we are paying the minimum wage, which we are for. I'm for the minimum wage. I think that's a good thing. I think that au pairs deserve to have the right financial support to explore and see amazing things. But I think what's being missed is what the host families are providing, which is all living expenses.
So I want to ask you a question there. You said earlier in our conversation that this could mark sort of a big end to or a decline in the program. There is some administrative hassle to getting timesheets and an employment contract, workers' comp. I've done all of those things before. Eventually, they get done. So that's a short-term hurdle. Why are you concerned about long-term impact on the program if you and the organization, this grassroots organization, are comfortable with the minimum wage aspect of this?
Comfortable with minimum wage, but it becomes a very difficult position for a host family to respect and honor the cultural exchange aspects that we're committing to by bringing these people from abroad and overseas who are coming here not to work. They're not coming here for jobs. They're coming here for the experience. And it makes it hard and difficult and challenging for us to honor that cultural experience if all of a sudden this has the dynamic of an employer-employee, if all of a sudden we have to cover every expense that they have while living here in the country, as well as minimum wage.
What's an example of something that would be lost?
My family's tradition, and true story, right? My family's tradition is to spend some time further north in snow, and we spend Christmas up there. We spend holidays up there. We have some New Year's cultural festivities that involve expenses. So all of a sudden now, if I cannot afford to bring my au pair along because I have all these added expenses and I'm not allowed to take the deductions for any living expenses I'm providing her, all of a sudden, that's not bringing her into the family, and that's not giving her the cultural experience that she's here to have. And that's awful. And if I can't give that cultural experience that I'm required to bring as part of the program, then I can't afford to be part of the program.
How much more will it cost you?
In general, for a year, probably an extra $20,000 to $24,000, I believe.
Okay. So what are you hoping to have happen now?
So I think, first of all, there's one thing that's absolutely needed, some breathing room. I think that a lot of families were caught off guard. A lot of au pairs were caught off guard. It's awful to see some of these au pairs being sent home because their families don't understand how to comply, can't afford it any longer. So I think we need some breathing room.
Sort of like this legislation that's out there that would basically put a pause on this until the end of June.
Yep. Grace period would be wildly appreciated. I think in that interim, what would be really helpful is taking the time. We want this to be a long-term success. We want this to be working for everyone because everyone that's been involved in it, most people get an extreme amount of benefit and value for it, whether it's the au pair or the host family, and there are amazing stories out there.
That was Kelly Callahan. She and her family have hosted au pairs in Harvard, Massachusetts. She's with the group Au Pair Families of Massachusetts. So now let's get some perspective from the other side. Joining us on the line is Tati Oliveira, a former au pair and a member and leader of the Au Pair Committee at the Mata Hari Women Workers Center. Tati, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you heard Kelly Callahan argue that there's this exchange that's deeply lost by turning au pairs into domestic workers or classifying them that way. How do you respond to that concern?
Well, I think it's a reality that folks are, you know, need to come to term that if an au pair is required to work 45 hours a week providing childcare, that is work, right? We can't just keep saying that this is an exchange, a cultural exchange, because when they're caring for children for that many hours, they're working. I don't think that it's going to be lost. I think there's still, you know, a lot of room that they can still participate and be part of the family. What we wanted just to make sure and continue to make progress in history is that childcare is real work, right?
Tati,
and it should be treated just like that.
When you began as an au pair, did you see it as coming for a job or did you see it as coming for a cultural exchange program?
I thought of cultural exchange. However, it was very clear to me that you know, I would be working with a family. And I can tell you, I was an au pair in 2003. I had a wonderful family. I had a good experience, but it was very soon understood from my point that I was the lucky one, right? My family didn't need me for 45 hours a week. I barely worked 30 hours a week, and I did have time to do a lot of things with them when I was off the clock. But this is not what's happening today. You know, we're having this conversation because families are relying on those 45 hours of childcare work. So if you put that into perspective, like how much time are these young people really having to enjoy the culture and to participate really in the American lifestyle, right?
Tati, what is then driving your level of engagement on this issue now? I imagine there are a lot of people who were former au pairs who are not becoming active advocates on this issue. You didn't have a bad experience and you came for cultural exchange, but you're motivated to get this involved now. So where's that coming from?
Absolutely. Well, I'm a professional nanny today. If it wasn't for the au pair program, I wouldn't have fallen in love for childcare. I wouldn't know that being a nanny could be a profession that I could choose as my career path. So I have been involved into the industry with the professionalization, really, of the industry in letting people know that it is a very, important work. It is much, you know, real. It's very important. And, you know, I think just going back with my history, but also seeing how the program hasn't changed in over 20, almost 20 years since I was an au pair, and I heard stories of my, you know, my au pair friends that had to come to my house to eat because they weren't being provided food. And then hearing more stories, you know, in Mata Hari of all the abuse that's still happening today. I think, you know, as I said, the program, I don't want the end program to end, but it just has so much room for bad things to happen. They have been happening. We just want more regulations, more protection. And what we're asking right now is really the minimum, right? So au pairs being entitled to minimum wage and, you know, overtime protection, it's really the minimum we can do. But there's a lot of things that we want the program to, you know, agencies and the state to be accountable for. So this problem can still continue.
So let's start with this. Let's start with this minimum wage issue. The Boston Globe estimates that it'll cost host families as much as $333 a week more.
Yeah.
What do you say to host families who say, I can't do that? I can't come up with another $350 in expenses every week.
Well, we're definitely, as I say, we are empathizing with the families because, you know, even though this has been in the law really passed over 5 years ago, I guess the agency really didn't do a good job keeping them in the loop of how this, you know, what was going to happen. We do have a child care crisis in the whole country, right? Child care is expensive. So it is something that not just the families, the au pair are struggling with. A lot of people are struggling with.
Care.com says that the average cost of in-home care is nearly $32,000 a year, and in-center care is $13,000 a year.
Yep.
So, I mean, this is a burden for families no matter what in Massachusetts.
It is. I'm not, you know, we empathize with this, but this shouldn't come at the cost of a worker, right? So in this, if we go back, or do you want to continue look at childcare as not real work? And I think if we go back, if they take this away, you know, unprotect au pairs, like we just go back in time, you know, continuing with the assumption that women work is not real work, the childcare is not real work. So what we're asking is just some basic minimum protections. You know, there's stuff we are definitely trying to figure out what could have been done, you know, from the agency side, from state levels, how can the program be better? But what I say is just it shouldn't come at the price of workers. Like we are workers just like any other workers.
Let's stay with that for a minute. Mm-hmm. So what about the argument that the higher costs will cause the au pair program to shrink? And as a result, not only will it be lost for host families, but actually people coming and hoping to participate in the au pair program may have significantly fewer opportunities. That would essentially be job losses in your argument. So what does one do about that?
Well, I honestly don't believe that it's going to shrink. I think there are probably going to be some adaptation period. I think we're going to be, of course, losing the families that are really using this program for the affordable labor and not really having the, you know, the experience or the time for these au pairs to have the culture exchange. So, you know, for me, one of the things I talk with some au pairs or even nannies in my community, they will say that they lost their jobs because of au pairs, because the family decided to go for an au pair because it was cheaper. You know, like we wanted to continue to be a true culture exchange, and I think that's what's going to happen.
So one more question on that front. You've talked several times here about the vulnerability of au pairs to different kinds of abuse, essentially, in the household. It's not entirely clear that this reclassification solves that problem. Kelly Callahan argued that, too. Do you see any merit to that argument, and is there more that needs to be done?
Well, I do. I do feel that, you know, with some new protections, like au pairs, they are, if they're included, and, you know, let's keep it with what they are domestic workers. We do have sexual harassment, you know, protection in the domestic worker law, right? So under those regulations, we have way more protections that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Last thing, to these host families who are worried about this development, what would your advice be?
Well, again, I think it's really important for them. Like, we want to work together, you know, but I think look at the big agencies, the corporate, they knew this was coming. They should definitely be held accountable for not letting the families know and not being better prepared for this. And we want to work together, so we are definitely listening. I work with families.
I'm sorry, Tati, I'm going to have to stop you there. That's Tati Oliveira, a former au pair and a member and leader of the Mata Hari Women Worker Center's Au Pair Committee. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. The beginning of the year is a banner time for self-improvement, to which many of us are trying to form new and better habits. It might be eating healthier or going to bed earlier, maybe not looking at your phone so much. But forming those habits can be a big task to take on. Habit formation expert BJ Fogg says to change big, think small. Fogg is the founder of the Behavior Design Lab at Stanford University and author of Tiny Habits, The Small Changes That Change Everything. While he was in town talking about that book, he stopped by Studio 3, and he told us the first thing to keep in mind is that we change best by feeling good.
There's very little evidence that taking big leaps and using willpower and motivation and guilt succeeds in the long term. And when people fail, they blame themselves. They don't blame the program that set them up to fail. They think, oh, somehow I'm damaged good. Somehow I lack willpower. I can't change. I'm bad at change. And one of the things I'm trying to do with Tiny Habits is help people see that it's not a character flaw. You're not the problem. You just haven't had the right way to change yet.
So early on in the book, you have this equation that is the right way to change. It's B equals MAP.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. So I call it the behavior model. And it is a model that describes any type of behavior. And it basically goes like this. A behavior happens when three things come together at the same moment. There's motivation to do the behavior. There's the ability to do the behavior. And there's a prompt. And when those three things come together at the same moment, you do the behavior. If one of those elements is missing, you don't do the behavior. And so this model applies to one-time behaviors, it applies to stopping behaviors, and it also applies to behaviors that we repeat, like habits.
Aren't there habits we need to build that just don't lend themselves to those three things easily but still need to be built? And if so, yeah. how does this apply there?
Well, let me go a little bit further. So this model applies to all types of behaviors. And so a habit basically is a behavior you do that gets wired into your brain. So you do it without thinking, without deliberating very much. And in Tiny Habits, I try to set the record straight that the way a habit forms is not through repetition, but what forms a habit is the emotion you feel as you do the behavior or immediately after. The way that you hack your habits, the way that you wire them in very quickly, is you cause yourself to feel successful as you do the behavior or immediately after. And it's that feeling that makes your brain take note and creates the habit.
How could repetition not create a habit, though? If you do it over and over again, muscle memory would suggest that.
Well, when you look at the research that most people cite, the most current research is a 2009-2010 study, and you look at that, that research was not designed to show causality. So the design of the research and the statistics shows a correlation between repetition and habits, but it doesn't show that it causes the habit to form.
So let's get very practical for our listeners. Why don't you give a couple examples of what this behavior equals motivation, ability, and prompt in a tiny way?
Yeah, and there's a part on the model where you will do the behavior, even if motivation's low, if it's easy enough, if it's super easy. So when I looked at my own model, I said, okay, what this is saying is I could create a habit and it wouldn't be subject to fluctuations in motivation if the habit is super, super, super tiny. So that's what I did. As an extension of one of my Stanford classes, I started coaching 6 people on putting on sunscreen, but it wasn't putting on a full face of sunscreen. It was one drop. And the team.
But what good is one drop of sunscreen?
Well, this is what we were exploring, right? I like breaking new ground. I like pushing to the extremes. And I instructed them on every day, you know, after you brush, put on one drop of sunscreen and so on. And it was so easy for people to do, even when they were busy or distracted or not so motivated, they could still do it. Then the next step in my own life was to play around with a whole bunch of habits in this way. For example, I felt kind of bad about not flossing my teeth. So I decided that I was going to pare it back to be just floss one tooth, find where it fits naturally in my life. So in this case, it's the prompt. What does it come after? What's going to prompt me? That's part of my model is prompt. And you don't use alarms or post-its. You find an existing routine to remind you. And in flossing, it's kind of obvious. It's like, after I brush, I will floss one tooth. And so that is the tiny habit recipe.
Okay, so I'm reading the book, and yeah. I read about the one tooth. And there's a piece of me that's like, yeah, no, I totally get that. And there's another piece of me that's like, I am not going to floss one tooth. I'm not going to do it because all my teeth need flossing. So yeah. Don't I just feel silly flossing one tooth?
Well, so I've coached over 40,000 people in this method, so I've seen all sorts of reactions. And some people react that way, and some people have mixed feelings like you do. One of the things in the Tiny Habits method is you can always do more than one tooth. You can do more than two push-ups. You can do more than pour the glass of water. But if you do more, you count it as extra credit. And it's not a requirement for the next time. You don't raise the bar on yourself. So, for example, say you want to do push-ups daily. And you might think, oh, it'd be nice to do 10 or 20. Well, set the bar really low, just one or two push-ups. But that's hard for you. Just do wall push-ups. And that then becomes the habit that you do every day. If you keep raising the bar, you're going to reach a point where you eventually fail. With tiny habits, you set yourself up to succeed every time. And the times you go beyond expectations, you chalk it up, like I said, extra credit. You're an A-plus student. You're the kind of person that goes beyond the minimum.
So what are the limits here? I mean, you talk in the book about these habits can scale, but at some point they stop scaling. You talk about the guy who now
planks
for 5 minutes. He's never going to plank for 50 minutes.
Yeah.
What if you need a 50-minute habit?
Well, you certainly can. Now, planking 50 minutes would be just extraordinary.
Yeah.
But there are some habits like planking that will top out. There are other habits that won't, or that you just run out of time in your day. There are habits where the intensity might get, let's take meditation, for example. So maybe you don't do longer meditation, but the quality of the meditation will increase. So there's different ways that habits improve and scale. And sometimes it's time, and we're all pressed for time. But other times it's quality gets better.
It's hard for me to imagine that there is any behavioral science that works for everyone. Are there personality types you've worked with that when you've collected the data, it just doesn't take for them?
Yeah, it's a great question. My work is looking at how behavior and habits happen for human beings generally. But you're right. There are some people that they've tried to do the big things before, and they know it doesn't work for them, and they, bam, tiny, I'm in. And then there's other people that say, wow, I need big changes, and they just can't understand that the way you get to big changes is by getting those habits rooted and then allowing them to grow, that it's a natural process, and it's the way things work naturally.
So what about breaking habits? I mean, there's forming habits, but then there's breaking habits.
Right. And it's a different process. Just like planting a little maple tree and growing it is different than pulling it out of the earth. But you can use the tiny habits method to help you. So if we go back to motivation, ability, and prompt, if you remove any one of those items, the behavior won't happen, including a bad habit. So I had the habit at restaurants of when bread or nacho chips would come, I would eat them. I mean, I love that stuff.
If the chips are on the table, I'm going to eat them.
Right. And I just recognized that. So I created a habit, and it went like this. After I see somebody approaching me with bread or chips, I say, no bread, please. Three words. What that did was two things at once. One, the prompt of having bread on the table saying, eat me, was not there. And my ability to eat bread was vastly reduced. Sure, I could reach over to somebody next to me. Yeah, I could reach over to somebody else's table and grab it. That would be awkward.
So let's compare and contrast. I tried two tiny habits sort of in preparation for our discussion. One was, short version is, I'd like to start playing the piano.
Yay.
There's a room I'm in every day where I have to turn the lights off, and there's a piano in the room. So I tried, before I turn the light off in this room, I will play one note on the piano.
Okay.
Which immediately became three, four notes, and then a chord. And never don't remember to do it.
Good for you.
The other one was I want to drink more water. There's a drinking fountain right outside the restroom here at the office. Every time I walk out of the restroom door, I will take a drink of water from the drinking fountain. I never remember to take a drink of water. And it's sitting right in front of me.
Yeah.
Why is one working and the other one isn't?
Well, if I had to guess, I mean, we could talk longer about it, is that you want the habit of playing the piano. There's something in that behavior that you want more. Your motivation is higher for that.
It's to connect with my son who loves music.
Okay.
Because I know he'd love me to be playing an instrument again.
Boom. There you go.
Okay.
And one of the things I talk about a lot in Tiny Habits is create habits you want, not the ones you feel like you should have.
Which would be the drinking more water.
Yeah. Now, some people really want to drink more water and they can readily create the habit. One of the classic problems is people try to form habits for things they don't really want. And that doesn't work very well.
Okay.
And so clearly there's two big maxims that I talk about in Tiny Habits. Number one, help yourself do what you already want to do, not what you think you should do. Number two, help yourself feel successful, because it's that feeling that wires in the habit.
Could these kinds of methods be applied to, let's say, something like OCD or addiction?
In terms of OCD, I'm not an expert on that, but the parents who have kids with that have applied it, and they report back to me that it works well. I'm likely not going to study that from a scientific perspective because it's not within my area of expertise. In terms of addiction, wow, that's complicated. We do need a lot more attention and understanding about addiction and how to help people. But forming habits is trivially easy compared to some of these challenging addictions.
All right. So when one understands what drives people's behavior and how to condition that behavior, there can be a fine line between that and manipulation or
Absolutely.
Controlling people's behavior. In 2018, Wired Magazine said that the Stanford lab that you run, quote, created the formula to make technology addictive, end quote, based on techniques that people were learning in your class as you explored this. What is your response to that?
That was an interesting article. There are statements in there that are just downright not correct. In 2007, Facebook launched what they call Platform. And it's my way to explore it. Like I do a lot of things, is just let's dig in and figure out what this means. And so I created a class at Stanford, and the students created apps for Platform. One of the main techniques that I taught the students was simplicity. Simplicity changes behavior, because I'd seen that over and over. And you fast forward today to Tiny Habits, it's about simplicity. And what the students learned in the class wasn't a whole bunch of influence or manipulation techniques. When Wired said that, they're wrong. What they learned is, how do you make something so easy to do that it doesn't require lots of motivation? In fact, as we were going through that class, we were about 3 weeks in, and the students were not shipping their apps yet, and I was getting nervous. So it was Friday, and I got up and I said, look, you've got to get an app into the ecosystem, or every day you don't have one there, you will lose half a grade for the entire quarter. So what happened typically was the smarter, more sophisticated engineers would say, well, we're going to keep working on our, you know, really cool app, and you who have less talent, go create something simple and stupid and just get it done by Monday. And what happened in every case without exception, the big, complicated, super cool app never took off. It was always the super simple one that took off. And that's what I preach today, is simplicity changes behavior.
And what ethical boundaries do you create for yourself or the students who learn from you about the power of understanding how people's behavior works?
Yeah. Well, I've addressed this since 1998 when I published my first academic/industry paper on this. Like, here's this thing, persuasive technology, it's coming. There's these really good things we can do with it, but there's a dark side to it. And I outlined, here are three dangers I see coming. One of them was data collection about individuals that would then be used, and I called it persuasion profiling. And in 2006, and I'd forgotten I'd said this until a couple years ago, I predicted that even elections might use this against us. Another thing that I warned about in 2006 was videos that you couldn't believe. I didn't have a name for it, but now we call them deepfakes. Deepfakes, yeah. And so I was trying to shine a spotlight on these things, and I naively thought that policymakers would listen and start regulating around it, which they didn't.
All right. So the prompt is, when listeners are done listening to this interview, what is an easy behavior you recommend to them if they are interested in starting to form a tiny habit?
I think if you can, what you should do is write down one person to whom you're feeling grateful for, and just write that name down. Now, later, what that might do is allow you to call them or text them or write them a thank you note. But if I said write a thank you note, that's too hard. So the tiny step you can take is just write down the name of that person and see what happens.
That's BJ Fogg, author of Tiny Habits, The Small Changes That Change Everything. He's also the founder of the Behavior Design Lab at Stanford University. Thanks for being here, BJ.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and Sarah Rose Brenner. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.